From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 3rd of December, 2008. On today's newscast, we'll hear why critics are dismissing a new report about bio and nuclear weapons. The Federal Reserve defends the practice of lending in low-income communities. And we'll go to Atlanta, where the Troy Davis case has reignited the death penalty debate. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more. But first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss has won a runoff election in Georgia against his Democratic challenger, Jim Martin. The incumbent received 57% of the vote, a huge increase over his count on November 4th when he couldn't break the 50% mark. Although high-profile Democratic supporters have been campaigning in Georgia for Martin, the party could not maintain the surge in Democratic voters it experienced on Election Day. Chambliss' victory makes a Democratic supermajority in the Senate impossible. With an industry on the verge of collapse, U.S. auto execs are once again in Washington this week, seeking more than $30 billion in emergency federal loans. It's a high-stakes drama for domestic auto workers and the millions of U.S. jobs dependent on the auto industry. Doug Cunningham of Workers Independent News reports.
Millions of jobs will be lost in this country if we lose this industry.
That's United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger at an emergency meeting of the UAW in Detroit today. Their union officials considered more concessions to help the auto companies secure federal loans. GM, Ford, and Chrysler, who presented recovery plans to Congress yesterday, employ roughly 250,000 people, and more than a million retirees get auto company pension checks. Gettelfinger says these federal bridge loans are critical to the industry's survival in the United States, and he says workers and their unions are not to blame for the auto industry's crisis.
Are we going to blame the auto workers who are, by the way, 10% of the cost of an automobile? Or are we going to take a look at what's happened to our economy, to the housing crunch, to the Wall Street bailout and the failures on Wall Street?
The UAW says it may scale back its jobs bank benefit that pays workers for a time after they're laid off. The union may also allow the auto companies to delay payments into a retiree health care trust fund. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Doug Cunningham in Madison.
In a historic agreement, Subway Restaurant, the world's fastest growing franchise, has entered into a partnership with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW. The company committed yesterday to work with the coalition to improve wages and working conditions for the Florida farm workers who harvest the tomatoes they use. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more.
For the past decade, the CIW has successfully organized for better wages and working conditions in Florida's tomato fields. Under the new agreement, Subway Restaurant will pay 1 penny more per pound for tomatoes from the Florida growers. The restaurant joins fast food giants McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Burger King, as well as a national supermarket chain Whole Foods, who have all signed similar agreements. But the money from at least two of those deals is accruing in escrow because the agreements don't stipulate how to distribute the funds to the workers. Subway's deal is similarly lacking. But the agreements with Subway includes more than just financial stipulations. According to Megan Cohurst, co-coordinator of the Student Farmworker Alliance, a partner organization with the CIW, Subway has also committed to a code of conduct monitored by farmworkers that will
ensure that there are no abuses, that there are no cases of physical violence, that workers are getting their wages, and that there are also, for example, no cases of modern-day slavery. The third is a three-way dialogue, a real voice for farmworkers in the agreement so that, you know, they are no longer under the table, but sitting at the table with the corporations that are purchasing essentially the fruits of their labor.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers says it will next put pressure on more national supermarket chains as well as the food service industry. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Null.
Fallout from the terrorist attacks in Mumbai continues today. Thousands of people swarmed the Gateway of India monument to join a rally in solidarity against terrorism. Last week's attacks left nearly 200 dead and 300 injured. PC Dubey has more.
The protesters in Mumbai held placards with anti-terror, anti-Pakistan and anti-Indian politicians' slogans and called for action against the terrorists. They also held candles to mourn the dead. Similar rallies have been held across the country where tens of thousands of people spontaneously poured into the streets and held candlelight vigils and peace marches. Political observers say this is the largest public outcry against terrorism in India's history. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrived in New Delhi today and is holding parleys with Indian leaders. She has counseled Pakistan to take direct and tough action against terrorism originating in their country. Back in Mumbai, police officials have announced today they found and defused two bombs at a major train station in the city. From Bethia in India, I am P.C. Dubey.
The U.S. Justice Department has slammed the state of Texas for conditions at facilities for the mentally disabled. From Austin, Ansel Herz has more.
Texas facilities for the mentally disabled consistently fail to protect the constitutional rights of their residents, according to a new report from the U.S. Justice Department. In a 62-page letter to Governor Rick Perry, investigators charged that Texas's system of mental institutions, the largest in the country, offers inadequate options for integrating their clients into communities. The letter also charges that the system has problems with healthcare, a disturbingly high rate of injuries to patients, and an ineffective monitoring system for abuses. The so-called state schools suffer from staff turnover rates as high as 70%. In one incident last February, a 17-year-old female patient reported being raped by a staff member. The incident was never properly reported or investigated. Advocates for the mentally disabled have long claimed that the institutions are chronically underfunded. The state of Texas could face a lawsuit from the Justice Department if it does not take immediate action. For FSRN, I'm Ansel Herz in Austin.
That's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
A new report says biological weapons are and will be more of a threat than nuclear weapons, although the congressionally mandated report doesn't dismiss the possibility of spreading nuclear weapons. It suggests biological weapons are easier to get a hold of and therefore a more immediate global danger. But critics say the report reveals nothing new and fails to address the U.S.'s role in the global arms race. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The report is called The World at Risk. The 10-member commission was appointed by Congress to follow up on the 9/11 commission's work. The 112-page report focused on weapons of mass destruction. It defined two types, nuclear and biological. A terrorist attack using weapons of mass destruction will happen somewhere in the world within the next 5 years, the report says, and it's up to the United States to control the spread and use of nuclear and biological weapons. Former Senator Jim Talent is the Republican chair of the bipartisan commission.
This is urgent and important, and it has to constantly be at the top of the menu.
The commission says a biological weapons attack is more likely than a nuclear attack because the technology is being developed around the world for purposes such as vaccines and is more accessible. 14,000 scientists are now working on biotechnology in the United States. The commission cites security lapses in U.S. laboratories and calls for more government oversight and regulation. It also calls for renewed international treaties eliminating bioweapons. As for nuclear weapons, the commission looked minimally at U.S. weapons policy and mainly assessed what it calls outside threats, terrorists obtaining nuclear materials, and countries expanding their weapons programs. Democratic chair of the commission, former Senator Bob Graham, talks about Iran and North Korea.
It would be extremely destabilizing in their regions if North Korea continues to add to its stockpile. The pressure on South Korea, Japan, to respond is going to be very difficult to resist. Similarly, if Iran gains capability, Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, other countries in the region are going to be under pressure to match Iran's capability.
The commission recommends that the Obama administration make nuclear-free Iran and North Korea a priority by using diplomacy.
But with the understanding that we are not taking from our range of options the use of direct force if the other means are unsuccessful.
The commission also recommends that Russia and the U.S., which control 95% of the world's nuclear weapons, work with China, India, and Pakistan to agree to a moratorium on their nuclear weapons. Chair Graham says the recently passed U.S.-India nuclear agreement could be an acceleration of nuclear proliferation.
The interest of proliferation was sublimated to geopolitical and economic interest, and that it has destabilized the nuclear proliferation.
The report fails to mention Israel, a U.S. ally and a country alleged to illegally build and possess nuclear weapons. It also fails to address the U.S.'s own proliferation and storage of nuclear weapons. Joseph Gerson is director of programs at the American Friends Service Committee. He says the commission report offers no new insight.
We need a policy that's based on common security. So while calling for the reversal of other nations' nuclear programs, it has to say that as part of our commitment to fulfill the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, we're going to negotiate the complete elimination of the world's nuclear arsenals.
The commission is also presenting their findings to members of Congress and the Obama transition team. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As many as 450 people may have been killed in attacks in Jos, Nigeria last week. The killings followed a much-anticipated local election last Thursday, which had been postponed several times due to concerns that inter-ethnic, inter-religious, and inter-communal tensions would lead to violence. Early morning Friday, violence between Christian and Muslim communities in Jos broke out. Corinne Dufka is a senior researcher with the Africa Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. She's currently in Nigeria.
As we have seen in the past in Nigeria, indeed there have been about 12,000 Nigerians killed in intercommunal clashes since the end of military rule in 1999. Once again, these deadly intercommunal clashes reared their head, and there were about 400 Nigerians killed in 2 days of violence here in Jos that began the morning of Friday the 28th and then continued into Saturday, November 29th. The official toll from the Plateau State government is about 200 dead, but we believe that that is very seriously underestimated. We believe the figures are 400, probably will, at the end of the day, after all the bodies are counted, will probably be closer to 450.
Dufka adds that it's important to keep in mind that this kind of violence was anticipated and that authorities should have had a better plan in place to deal with it.
The intercommunal and interreligious clashes run very deep in Nigeria. I think this kind of violence came as no surprise to residents in Jos. And so, indeed, the policing authorities primarily should have anticipated this violence and perhaps deployed preventatively to some of the reacted very neutrally, which I think is in question here, to members of all communities. Now, once it became clear that the violence was very, very, and it really ignited on the morning of Friday 28th. There were groups of 20, 30, 40 youth from the Christian community and to a lesser extent from the Muslim community attacking each other's communities, mosques, Islamic schools, Christian establishments, churches, and so on. So the governor did call in the army quite quickly to try to restore order and then issued a shoot on site policy, which Human Rights Watch has taken a position against because it's contrary to international law.
Human Rights Watch is calling for an investigation into whether fraudulent practices were used in this election to examine the roots of this violence, and they're also demanding the government address the issue of discrimination against non-local Muslims. You're listening to FSRN. Some critics attacked a law that encourages banks to lend to low-income communities after the mortgage crisis hit. But the Federal Reserve is defending this law and affirms the importance of lending in poor areas. Tanya Snyder reports.
The Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, is a 30-year-old law that says that banks need to lend to the communities they've received deposits from. The law tried to curb the practice of redlining, where banks refuse to invest in poor neighborhoods.
You can't suck money out of a community without also lending and investing in that community.
When the subprime mortgage crisis began to surface, some analysts and conservative lawmakers blamed the CRA. But David Beck, who works for Self Help, an organization in North Carolina that lends to low-income borrowers, disagrees.
CRA is a long-proven healthy way to invest in low-income communities, and the CRA loans that have qualified for CRA credit have performed very well.
Self-help and other community organizations refute the charges by business groups and Republican lawmakers that the CRA coerces banks into lending for reasons of political correctness to people who aren't worthy of the loans. Now the Federal Reserve has thrown its weight behind the Community Reinvestment Act. The Fed worked with a Brookings Institution, a Washington-based think tank, to investigate what impact the CRA had on the mortgage crisis. Randall Krosner is a board governor of the Federal Reserve.
Contrary to the assertions of critics, the evidence does not support the view that the CRA contributed in any substantial way to the crisis in subprime mortgage market that we're seeing today.
The CRA identifies communities by zip code as target areas, so the study looked at communities with similar income levels where some are CRA target areas and some are not, and it found that there was no difference in loan delinquency between the two. So the CRA wasn't forcing banks to make bad loans, as critics charged. And Krosner noted that the institutions covered by the CRA weren't the ones causing the problem.
Only 6% of all the higher-priced loans were extended by CRA-covered lenders to lower-income borrowers or neighborhoods in their CRA assessment areas. Only 6%. This result really undermines the assertion by critics that the potential for a substantial role of the CRA in the subprime crisis.
David Beck agrees.
The AmeriQuests and Countrywides of the world were not depository institutions, so they weren't doing any CRA lending.
And Randall Krosner says the CRA doesn't just help poor people. It helps banks, too.
The law has encouraged banks to be aware of lending opportunities in all segments of the community, as well as learn how to undertake such lending in a safe and sound manner.
The study focused on concentrated poverty, geographic areas of high unemployment, and low incomes. The Community Reinvestment Act seeks to help low-income geographic areas, not individual low-income people. The researchers found that concentrating poverty creates negative cycles that can be hard to escape. Alan Berube of the Brookings Institution says that these areas were ground zero for risky subprime lending over the last several years.
Not attributable to the CRA, but just attributable to the fact that these are market-isolated communities in the first instance that were more vulnerable to these types of loans and the way they were marketed. Now these communities really are in the front lines of the fallout.
Carolina Reed works at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. She says that government policies often exacerbate the problem of concentrated poverty.
Unintended consequences of housing policies that serve to concentrate poor families in public housing in poor neighborhoods. But also, we found a lot of direct legacy from urban renewal programs and really forced relocation of African American families. And then the Native American Indian reservations were clearly the result of federal policies.
If federal policy created the problem of concentrated poverty, the study argues it's only natural that another government policy, the Community Reinvestment Act, would try to remedy it. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
The Bush administration isn't holding up its end of the bargain on the bailout. That's according to internal government watchdogs. In the first of a series of congressionally mandated reports, the Government Accountability Office found that there isn't adequate oversight over the distribution of the $700 billion. They add the administration has to work harder to make sure that banks are complying with the plan's limit on executive pay. But it's not Bush's fault that his nominee for Special Inspector General over the bailout hasn't even started work yet. The Senate still hasn't approved his confirmation. A hearing was held in San Francisco this week challenging the legality of the law that allows the executive branch to grant immunity to telecommunications companies. Dozens of lawsuits have been filed against telecoms, which are accused of giving the National Security Agency millions of U.S. citizens' communications without warrants. But changes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allowed the Bush administration to grant telecoms retroactive immunity against lawsuits, Africa Jones reports.
Changes made by Congress this summer to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allow the U.S. Attorney General to dismiss any court case filed against telecom companies involved in spying on its customers for the U.S. government. Rebecca Jensky is a spokesperson for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the plaintiffs in the case.
The immunity law puts the fox in charge of the henhouse. In the United States constitutional system, we have co-equal branches of government, and the judiciary's role is to determine the scope of the surveillance and whether or not it's legal. What the government wants to do here is to have the executive branch decide whether spying, this kind of warrantless spying on Americans, is illegal or not. It does not allow for any examination by the judiciary. It doesn't allow for our court system to work.
Plaintiffs say this lack of examination is unconstitutional. The government has argued that it needs expanded powers to continue the so-called war on terror and that telecommunications companies should not be held liable for following the orders of the executive branch. But civil liberties groups say the law replaces the constitutional rights of judicial review as well as state privacy laws. They also say the law could allow telecommunications companies to break the law in the future. Richard Wiebe is co-counsel for the plaintiffs.
It's really a statute designed to create this shadow play of judicial process, this veneer of judicial process, without actually allowing courts to do what they ordinarily do, which is independently find the facts and the law.
The Bush administration says it only uses surveillance to prevent terrorism, but in October it was reported that NSA spied on intimate conversations between Americans, not terror suspects. Congress is investigating those claims. In 2006, civil liberties groups filed suit accusing the government of monitoring the communications of millions of people without warrants, as the FISA law originally required. Richard Wiebe.
One of the claims in our lawsuit is that there was a mass dragnet surveillance that sucked in emails and telephone calls from across the country indiscriminately. Now, the government, as part of its certification, has said that there was no such dragnet.
But EFF's Rebecca Jinsky says that they have evidence that the government did spy on Americans indiscriminately without warrants.
EFF's case has uncontested evidence from a former AT&T telecommunications technician whose name is Mark Klein, who helped hook up a secret room that diverted almost all internet traffic from, you know, AT&T to the National Security Agency. And if it's happening at AT&T, there's no reason to believe it's not happening at other telecommunications companies.
A decision in the case could come at any time. If the groups win, they say they will proceed with their lawsuit against telecom companies. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
Attorneys for death row inmate Troy Davis will present arguments next week before a panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The three judges will rule on whether Davis, sentenced to life for the killing of a Savannah police officer in 1989, can file a second federal challenge to his conviction. Seven of nine witnesses have either recanted or changed their testimony, and new evidence suggests that a different man may have committed the crime. But that new evidence hasn't been admitted or heard in a trial, and Davis maintains his innocence. Public outrage and the publicity surrounding the case and Davis's last-minute challenge have revived the death penalty debate in Georgia. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer has more from Atlanta.
I don't believe they should kill him. I don't believe in death penalty. I don't believe in death penalty. Somebody took your life. You should take theirs. They said stick him in jail.
Everybody deserves their life.
In Woodruff Park in downtown Atlanta, a group of men play cards while they debate the morality of capital punishment. Troy Anthony Davis's case has been in the news since September, when worldwide protests and legal challenges delayed his execution only 2 hours before it was scheduled. Here in the streets, many Georgians seem convinced of Davis's innocence, or at least that he doesn't deserve to die.
I believe they should investigate it and keep the man off death row, and they really should investigate it and then get to the bottom of it.
I think they should find out whether the man is telling the truth or not. Because if he's telling the truth, that means they got the wrong man. You know, since they're killing somebody that's innocent, what's that going to prove?
The whole reason for capital punishment is you're punishing someone for killing someone else. And so I'm just thinking to myself, does that justify you killing someone else?
If the circuit court judges rule against Davis, his execution could be scheduled for as soon as 10 days following, and there will likely be hundreds of protesters back in the streets. Waiting for the bus, an office worker named Ellen says she's heard a bit about Troy Anthony Davis's case, but isn't convinced either way about whether Davis is guilty. She does support the death penalty, however, as long as it's handed out responsibly.
I think that there probably are some people that are innocent on death row, and I think that the judicial system should ensure that guilt is proven, and if there is evidence of a possibility of innocence, then it has to be revisited. We just can't kill people without having the justification to do so.
And what about the mistakes?
It would be very unfortunate, and from what I've seen, death penalty cases take many years before they actually do serve their ultimate sentence, and there's probably ample time for defense attorneys to bring forth any claims that could prove innocence.
But Sarah Tatanchi, chair of the board for Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, says those defense attorneys are not so easy to come by, and that's a major factor in why capital punishment is doled out unfairly.
Earlier this year, the state of Georgia executed Curtis Osborne, who was a poor man accused of capital murder, who was represented by a lawyer who carried 600 other cases while he was representing Mr. Osborne. On top of that, his lawyer was so awful that he referred to Mr. Osborne as an N-word who deserved to die. There are other cases where poor people who couldn't afford lawyers were represented by real estate attorneys who had never tried a death case before.
There was a bit of good news on Election Day for abolitionists in Georgia. State Representative Barry Fleming, a staunch death penalty advocate, lost in his bid for a congressional seat and is completely out of office, for now. One of Fleming's more well-known bills would have required only 9 members of a jury to vote for a death sentence instead of the current unanimous 12 jurors needed. Fleming's failed campaign this year tread on fear and the desire for revenge as well, with his first campaign ad accusing incumbent Paul Brown of not being tough enough on pedophiles.
What could be more important than the safety of our children? That's why I will never understand how Paul Brown could repeatedly vote against legislation that would do just that. He even voted against protecting our children from online sexual predators.
It's a tried-and-true political strategy that taps into primal emotions. Casey, a gay rights activist herself, admits the concept of revenge is enticing.
An eye for an eye is not necessarily a very commendable thing because it's like playing God. But at the same time, coming from a personal standpoint, if somebody, say, raped or killed somebody that I was extremely close to, I can't honestly say that I wouldn't go trying to kill him. I wouldn't justify myself for doing it, but I can't say that I wouldn't want it done either.
But while the tough on criminals mantra makes change unlikely on the state level, Tatanchi says she has some hope that the incoming Obama administration might overturn the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, or ADPA, a 1996 federal law which has made it much more difficult for Troy Anthony Davis and inmates like him to challenge their death sentences. The law restricted federal court review of judgments made by state courts and established shorter timelines for death row inmates to introduce new evidence. For FSRN, from Atlanta, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Musician, singer, actor, and activist Odetta died Tuesday in New York. Born on New Year's Eve in Birmingham, Alabama in 1930, many called Odetta the voice of the civil rights movement. In a statement, her manager, Douglas Yeager, said, "May Odetta's luminous spirit and volcanic voice from the heavens live on for the ages."
Rich gal wear a brogan shoe, the poor gal wear a slipper. I don't care what old Jack say, I'm on a ride in a Lincoln or Zephyr.
Odetta performing at the Newport Jazz Festival in California. She toured all over the U.S., and her 1963 Odetta Sings Folk Songs rose to the top of the folk music charts. And over the last 2 years alone, she played 60 concerts. Odetta was recently hospitalized for kidney failure, but her manager said she was determined to get better and perform at President-elect Obama's inauguration. Odetta died at the age of 77 Tuesday in New York City. And that will do it for today's newscast. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.